Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode number 7. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I am taking the high road up to Jedburgh in the Scottish Borders to talk to Alan Gamble. Alan, how are you?
I'm very good, Will. Good to speak to you.
You too. You had a good weekend?
Yeah, it has been. It's been quite a sort of working weekend, as most weekends seem to be. We had cows calving this morning, one thing and another, so between that and a bit of tidying up and just general farming Sunday, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, there's me thinking you'd be like sitting down, letting the robots do all the work. I thought that was the
well, they do it. We try that as much as we can, but the cows still need a bit of like an after. So it's that thing. It's just whenever you've got stuck, there's always something to go on and something to do, and sort of there's kids here last night, sort of a Eurovision party and one thing and another, so
Right, okay.
Well, I hope Sarah got her blue rinse washed out from your party you were at last night as well.
Well, that's right, yeah. It was a good party. I was driving actually. Sarah was a bit fragile this morning, which I enjoyed.
Yeah.
So you're farming in the Scottish Borders. Can you tell us a bit about the area where your farm is?
We farm just outside the small town of Jedburgh, that's kind of just north of the Carter Bar, which is where the Scottish border. It looks like a really proper border, so it's a hill with a border right on top of the hill. There's a viewpoint thing. We're probably, 8 miles north of that, and then we're just along the Kelso Road. So we're in some really nice farming country. There's a lot of, most of this area will be kind of arable mixed farms. As you look out the front of the house, you look up towards St Cuthbert's Way. It's at the top end of the farm, and it's the track that the monks used to take from Melrose across the Holy Island.
Oh wow, okay.
And then up to, not actually beside our farm, but a field length away from us, and there's Deer Street. That's one of the old Roman roads that runs north to south, along the line of the A68. And as you look out, it's the back of the house, but it seems like the front of the house because it's the first bit you kind of get to. And you look across and you'll see Pinnochuich. It's a hill, and there's a Waterloo Monument on it. And it's a tower that was built by the tenantry of Lothian Estates, of which we're a tenant. And it was set out I can't remember exactly what year it was built, but it was to commemorate the Battle of Waterloo. All the woodlands round the hill are set out the same way as the armies were. So somebody told me this. That's right. And I was speaking to Lord Lothian, and he was actually saying, yes, it is. And whenever you look at some of the old maps, you can see that the woods are actually, they really are set out the way the armies were. Although over the years, there's been bits added to them, and the actual cores of the woods are all still the original shape. So some did a lot of vision whenever they were planting. It was a Marquess of Lothian, and I'm desperately trying to remember what it says on the plaque on the side of the thing, but I can't. It's a while since I've been up there.
I'm going to get straight on Google after we finish this.
I thought that'd be the kind of thing that was put your book.
That's fantastic. Thing, yeah. So. Yeah, I didn't realise you were on a Roman road there as well. I guess they were marching up to the wall, I suppose. Fantastic. Yeah, I've been through the area a few times because I think I've mentioned to you on Twitter before. I've got friends and family a bit sort of further north of you, so I've been up along sort of through Hoyk and up to Kelso, so it's not too far away from you, is it? It's a lovely, it is a beautiful farming area, isn't it? Some lovely rolling hills.
Yeah, and it's the bit of the world we're in, we probably don't get the best of the weather, but we don't get the worst of it either.
Yeah, okay.
You know, there's a friend sort of lives just across the hill, and that's what his dad used to say, and excuse me, to be fair, I think he's probably right, because it's, you know, it's like we've the last, well, everybody's sort of saying about rain, we haven't really had any significant rain since the start of April, you know, and then I think there was 2 days with sort of 12 or 14 mil of rain, and that's been it since then. And you know, the last couple of days we just had a couple of mil, but not really enough to do more than slake the dust for an hour, and you know, we're kind of back to square one again. So.
Yeah, but because you have had flooding in the past, though, haven't you? Because is it the Tweed? Yeah, is it the Tweed? There's flood.
No, it's the Teviot.
Okay.
There's in December, December 15. This is 76. 15,
yeah.
We had quite a lot of. We had about 250 acre of ground underwater. There's the main road cuts through, well, more or less. It's not quite the centre of the farm. It's about half the ground is on the river side of the A698.
Okay.
And there's a flood bank at the bottom of the river, and the river was so high it ruptured the flood bank. And the whole of that side of the river flooded, the road flooded, and then it actually came across the main road as well.
Yeah.
And flooded about halfway up the fields up towards the house. So we reckon it's about 250 acre of ground underwater. So it was a... Yes, this farm is a farm that really suits dry weather. We're basically on a floodplain. Whenever you're ploughing some of the ground down towards the river, you can really see where the bed of the river's been. You can see the soil type changing as you move across the field where the bed of the river's been. So, water's usually not something we're struggling for.
So, what crops are you growing there, Alan?
We're growing predominantly grass for feeding cows, both silage and grazing, and then we let out some ground for potatoes, and we've got a couple of fields of wheat and a couple of fields of barley, so which really give us straw and feed, and we sell some of the wheat and things, but it's really, really straw and feeding we're after for cows.
Yeah.
So to really get us as much, you know, the things that sort of changed around the last few years is what we've been doing, so due to circumstance and kind of necessity and extra cows, and really try to keep cost out of the thing. And, you know, the milk's the biggest thing that we do, so it's really trying to make sure that's fit, and, you know, it keeps the cost as low as possible.
So you're very much a family operation there, aren't you?
Yeah, we're farming about 440 acre. Mm-hmm. Myself and my wife, Kate, basically do everything.
Okay.
There's contractors do all the arable work. We're just not geared up to do it quite enough and in a timely enough way. So we've got a kind of an agreement with a neighbour that does. They do it. That's kind of a group that we're part of. We kind of own a combine between five farms now, is actually. And we have two grain drills in the group. There's a couple of big ploughs. There's a couple of sprayers. So we kind of do everything between us, and people kind of gear up to do different things and work together. So we're not kitting up. Yeah, we don't have five farms kitted up to do the same thing on a small acreage, whereas we can actually do the whole lot in one sort of semi-sensible size.
Meantime,
when it comes to marketing grain and things, we do a lot of it through the group as well. We buy fertilizer. Well, we don't, but we buy fertilizer and chemicals and things are bought through the group as a core. It just gives you that wee bit of buying power as well. Hopefully we can get better deals as well.
Yeah, well, I think that's becoming more common, isn't it, really, around the country, people doing the buying groups.
And I think it's important, though, really, for farmers to try and work together, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all going basically in the same direction, and anything we can do, you know, there's less and less of us, and kit, you know, especially kit's getting more and more expensive, and you sort of look at these massive machines, you think... You can't justify it over a small acreage. You know, some guys can, some guys do, depending on what they want them to do. But you know, for reliability and everything else, you sort of think, actually, we need to be kitting up to do a decent acreage in a sensible time. And the way weather patterns and things seem to be shifting, it's getting more and more important for you. Yeah. More and more and less time. Yeah. There's less available field days to get work done.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you got two children.
Yep, two children, Robert and Isla. Yep. Yeah. 16 going on 26, and and 11 going on 35, I think.
Okay. But they help. I know they help out on the farm quite a lot, don't they?
Yeah, they do quite a bit. I'm not sure that Robert will be a farmer, or Isla might. Josh, he might be a farmer, but at the end of the day, it's up to themselves. But they do help out and do, you know, they're out every evening helping us gather up cows and anything that we're needing to do. They'll give us a hand with them. So it's all a good pocket money spinner for them as well.
That's right.
You know, once the hard currency is mentioned, it's amazing what you can get done from them.
That's right. Well, yeah, we drive in next, I suppose.
Well, that's a frightening thought. Yeah, so I think we'll have to go and try and find a little mini metro or something.
So you're not really from a farming background, Alan.
No, I'm not. I'm the son of a builder.
Yeah.
A building contractor in Northern Ireland. And we always, to be fair, we always had farms. We used to run quite a lot of store cattle and graze cows and this kind of thing. We kind of had a fairly small farm of our own. And then we had a cousin to the farm as well, of which Dad kind of owned a bit of it. But to be honest, I was never really going to stay at home and work along with them. It just wasn't for me. There was going to be a major fallout somewhere along the line, so
yeah.
I kind of got shipped off to college to actually start to go and do engineering.
Yeah,
which I did. I did the start of a degree in engineering, and then after the first year and a half, I thought, "What the hell am I doing this for?" So, and then I actually took a bit of time out and worked for Rolls Royce.
Oh, okay. Year. Yeah,
and had a great time working in Newcastle. It was basically being a student with money, so it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then at the end of that, I sort of thought, no, this really isn't floating my boat. This isn't what I want to be doing. So I thought, right, I'll go and went back to do agriculture, what I loved doing and wanted to do anyway.
Did deep down you think you probably always wanted to do that?
Yeah. I'd always, whenever at home, I'd always wanted to be.
Yeah.
You always wanted to be working with the stock. Always wanted to be working on the farm rather than helping in the building site and doing whatever else. But it was always the farming end of things I really was interested in and really wanted to do. So I took the opportunity and thought, right, I'll do agriculture. So I did agriculture at Newcastle.
Yeah.
Had a whale of a time.
I bet you did.
As I think every agric always has and always will, no matter what college you go to.
Well, that's right, yeah.
And then from Newcastle, I actually got a job working for local to here in Kelso, crop chemical company, Wallace of Kelso.
Okay.
And I actually lived in the farm that we're now neighbours to over the hill.
Oh, right.
So we've kind of came a bit full circle.
Yeah, yeah.
Worked as an agronomist for them for 4 years, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, I've been from a graduate in 1996 to 1999, and then summer 1999, I thought, no, I'm needing to get to the other side of the industry, into the sort of the management side, or into the actual physical farming side of things.
Yeah.
And then took a job with Elkhorn. And worked for them for about 6 months, the longest 6 months of my life down in Lincolnshire.
Okay.
and then it's you know, like Velcourt, yeah, it's a good setup, big management company.
Yeah.
But why I went in as a trainee manager with them and as an under manager.
Mm-hmm.
And really it's geared up for a young lad straight out of college with no ties.
Yes.
Or anything else, that's great. But I was married and we were kind of wanting to start putting down roots and you know, this kind of thing, and they were quite into this whole idea of shifting about and that. And
yeah.
Worked in Lincolnshire for 6 months and sort of thought, right, the hell with this thing. Got offered the under manager job at South West Farms up at Breakin.
Okay.
Worked, so went there as under manager and took over as manager about a year later and was there for 11 years running it. So it was about a 4,000 acre arable farm, and we grew rape, barley, wheat, spring barley, potatoes, and then I'd say we were there for about 11 years and we started our own kind of own enterprises at that stage as well. So
okay.
We established the Farnall Pedigree Simmental Herd. That's okay. Where the prefix came from, because we were the farm we stayed on was just beside the village of Farnall.
Okay.
So we got Farnall as our prefix, and that was our first foray really into farming in our own right.
Yeah.
And then
So you and Kate started that together while you were there.
Yeah, that's when we were up there. We got, you know, it was that ludicrous thing. You end up working all day and then at South Esk and then working all night with Cal.
Yeah.
And at that stage, Robert would have been, what, 1, 2?
Yeah.
You know, the cows arrived actually we got them in the February and Ida was born in the April. So, you know, so, and we had sort of a few
busy
cattle and things up there as well. So,
it
worked away and got us a start and got us some numbers built up and a bit of capital built up and one thing and another.
Yeah.
And then we were kind of looking for various opportunities in our own right and, you know, to farm ourselves. And then we got the opportunity of the tenancy down here at Palace. We came here on the 23rd of December, 2009, with 3 float loads of cattle, 2 dogs, 3 hens, 2 kids, and no furniture that arrived the next morning. So we moved into the biggest house we've ever lived in. The living room's a huge living room.
Yeah.
And we had the world's smallest Christmas tree. The Christmas tree is about a foot tall. The idea was to have our first Christmas here rather than a last Christmas in the old place.
So yeah.
We shifted down and then the snow started. And it snowed. We were here for about 2 months before we saw the farm without either 2 feet of snow or 3 foot of water on it. So it was a bit of a baptism of fire. So we've got here and that was our us really starting our own right, really. And then from that we ended up we obviously had the Simmental herd, so we built their numbers up and up. And we used to buy quite a lot of store cattle and finish stores.
Yeah.
So we did that. And then growing arable crops and, you know, wheat, barley. We didn't grow rape, but we were growing a couple of oats and things as well. Did that for a few years and didn't really make a lot of money at it, to be perfectly honest, because we had no single farm payments. We were doing it very much at the sharp edge of things, that we hadn't the subsidy to fall back on.
Yeah.
So when things went wrong, they could potentially go very wrong. But we managed to hang in. In the really wet year of 2012, we were trying the Melbourne word to sow winter grain on the far side of the road. And I was looking at this and just thinking, what the hell are we doing this for? This just isn't happening. This, we need to think seriously about what we're doing here. So I'd always had the kind of hankering to milk cows again anyway. So
yeah,
I hadn't quite told Kate that this is what I was thinking at this point. So I sort of took a few feelers out and thought, you know, did a sat down, did a few sums and thought, actually we could milk cows here and this farm would work quite well for it in the way it's set up and everything
else. Yeah.
And there's sort of the way it is, there's the steading with 200 odd acres of ground around it. And then there's a road, and there's 200 odd acre of ground on the other side of the road. So it would actually work. It was going to work quite well. So sort of found out a few people that were milking and suggested, you know, eventually brought it up with Kate. And she said, well, it'll be all right. And I thought, well, that's a bonus. I'm supposed to. That's looking quite good. So and then I threw down a Delaval brochure.
Yeah.
I said, we can get a parter actually quite, quite cheap.
Yeah.
And you sort of square it up. It says, if you think I'm milking twice a day, if not three times in a day in a parrot, you've got another thing coming. I'll divorce you. I was like, okay, better think again then. So we looked in at robots, and I'd seen robots a lot of years ago up at Incharn Hall milking cows, and I was really impressed just with the cows, how quiet they were, how ready they were just to be, you know. For me, walking in among them at straw courts just where I was a complete stranger, they just didn't feel them at all. So I thought, man, this robot keeper might work. So we went and looked at a couple of farms with robots on them, but without any of the robot manufacturers or salesmen knowing about it, because there's nothing worse than when you look at something for the first time and somebody's bending your ear that, oh, X, Y, and Z are the best things
to
sliced bread.
Yeah.
So we looked at a few farms, and then we thought, aye, this could be the way forward. We kind of costed it out and really, really realised that for us to put in a parlour, to the time we put in a parlour, plus all the infrastructure around it, it was actually going to work out much the same as sticking robots in. So we ended up sticking robots in, and we originally planned to put up a shed and everything to do it, and that kind of got knocked in the head because the grant scheme finished and one thing or another. So that got kind of knocked in the head. We were going to apply for an SRDP grant to put up a shed as a, you know, an industry improvement kind of thing. And the day we put in the statement and attempt to pull the plug in the scheme, so I thought, well, if somebody's telling us something, we'll not be doing that. So then we looked at some of the sheds we had and thought, actually, we could convert this. And we got the lily guys here that we'd kind of plumped for, that we thought the lilies would go to the best option for us.
Okay.
They came and looked and said, there's no reason we can't stick a robot in the end of the shed here. So we kind of spent a fair bit of time looking at sheds and designing sheds to get the thing to actually work. And stuck first robot in May 2013 and smelt the first cow through the 28th of May 2013. And never really looked back since. We've been milking cows ever since.
That's a hell of a...
Started quite well. The milk price was quite good to start with.
Yeah.
First year odd, the diet was looking quite rosy, and we were getting 30 odd p a litre at one stage. I think, Christ, this isn't too bad. Make a living out of this.
Yeah.
And then the shit hit the fan. As the milk price dropped.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you'll be well aware, and hopefully your listeners are too, that, you know, the milk price just started to drop and drop and drop and drop. And the last 2 years have really been very, very tough, you know, for everybody in the dairy industry,
myself
included. Because looking back, this time last year, we were in 16.5 p a litre.
Which is below the cost of production, isn't it?
So you know, Kate was getting the milk check, you know, saying, well, what do you do with this?
Yeah.
There's not enough to share around here. No. How do we do this? And, you know, whenever times are hard, you really discover who your friends are.
You do.
You know, so,
yeah, well, we've all been there, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So we actually shifted dairies three times now. So we're actually with Graham's, the family dairy now. And we've been in another robot there in 1st of December last year. So
yeah.
We're milking 140 cows now. And we're 2/3 of the way through converting to organic for them. So things are actually looking, it's been bloody tough getting here. Things are actually looking quite good, and looking quite rosy going forward. And the opportunity is there. We've changed, we've adapted, we've tried to get ourselves and fought long and hard to get ourselves into the position that we're in now. That we've got a really good viable future for ourselves and for the farm. So
Well. First of all, I think you've answered all the questions I was going to ask you there. So that's it. Interview's finished. Well, I think that it's hugely impressive how far you've come in a relatively short time. You know, from you know, you've obviously really taken the opportunities that have come your way.
What kind of triggered at one stage was when we were at South Esk, there was a farm came up for sale. I think it was for sale, up quite close to where we were. And we sort of looked at it and thought, this would actually suit us. You know, the type of place it was, this would suit kind of what we were wanting to do and everything else. And we realised that we couldn't actually do it. There was no way that we could actually buy the farm or run it. We could kind of do one or the other.
Yeah.
But we weren't going to be able to get the backing to do both. So we sort of, at that point, then we both sat down and thought, right, we need to make sure that if an opportunity like that appears, that we can grasp it and go for it.
Yeah.
And that's really what we geared ourselves up. That's really what the Simmental started off being, as a way to raise a bit of capital, raise a bit of credibility. You know, that you're not just, like, for new entrants, it's an incredibly tough industry to get in. Agriculture is a very, very exclusive industry.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of people, there's a lot of farmers' sons farming that have got the farm and have never really had to think about it. They've never had to go away and think, right, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? How am I going to get the best out of this?
Totally agree.
They'll do what dad's done.
Yeah.
They'll do what granddad's done. And I think, to be fair, I think a lot of the younger generation, that's maybe changing a bit now because times have been hard. And there's guys will be looking at it and think, well, right, we've always grown wheat. Why the hell do we grow wheat if we're losing money at it?
Yeah.
Why we've always finished cattle. I don't like cows. Why are we doing this? No, let's stop the cows. Let's go and buy, I don't know, pigs or sheep or chickens, whatever, to do something different. And I think now there's some of the young men and women that are taking over farms are maybe changing to a degree that they're wanting to do what they want to do, and they've seen, you know, they've seen the classic pictures, you know, whenever you see, you know, dad's 94, son's 65, and dad's saying, I'll give you the checkbook, and I'll find the checkbook. You think, well, hang on a minute here. You know, in succession, you know, it's one of the big buzzwords of the industry, it's at the minute. But at the end of the day, it's things have to change, and there's a lot of people out there would dearly love to have opportunities to do what we've done.
Hmm.
But the thing is, you've got to make sure you can grab it. You've got to make sure you can do it. You know, and it's, I mean, you know, fair enough, I've got the degree in agriculture, but basically I'm winging it, as I think everybody does.
Well, I think we're all doing that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because every year is different, every farm's different, every cow's different, every field's different, and it's all about adaptability, it's all about change, it's all about doing what's right for you. Like, if you and I swap places, you would farm here in a completely different way than I do, and I would farm your farm in a different way than you do.
That's right.
And it's always going to be that, because it's always going to be driven. You know, everybody puts their own stamp on a farm, their own way of doing things. It's really noticeable that whenever you're a manager and you go onto a farm, and the previous manager has maybe done things one way, and you're thinking, right, is he doing that? Is that the right way to do it, or do I need to change that? And to some degree, you'll always change it a bit so that it's your way of doing it, not his. It's your way.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of needs to happen. But it must be a lot harder to do that if it's your dad's the previous incumbent and he's saying, you're heading for a fall, son.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, I guess that's something that, in a way, agriculture is quite unique in that aspect, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But no, I think you're right.
It's got to be the only industry. It's got to be one of the only industries that you can work with your family on a close day-to-day basis.
Mm.
And your day away will be going to an agricultural show, showing cattle. You know, and it's, there's not many accountants will go to the accountancy show for their weekend off, as opposed to we'd all head up to the Royal Highland Show or whatever. So, it can be a way of life. But that's not necessarily the way you should look at it, I think.
No, I think, you sort of made the point there. There's a lot of younger people trying to get in and change things. And I think you only have to look on social media to see that, don't you? There's some really sort of bright people trying to get in, and they really, you know, they're wanting to work hard and really forge a career for themselves, aren't they? And I think that it's got to be encouraged, doesn't it? Because...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. And it's so good whenever you see new starters, not necessarily young people, but the tend, I suppose they tend to be young people, but anybody when you start wanting to do something, wanting to try it and getting a break.
Yeah.
And from my own experience, the breaks you get aren't necessarily where you think you might get them.
Mm.
And the people, there's a lot of people that will be, you know, we sit around in robotic milk, there's a lot of people, oh, that'll never work. And you think, well, yeah, it will.
Yeah.
It has to. I'm not going to invest this amount of money.
No.
And then, but it was interesting. It was a lot of it, the people that were saying that were kind of my age or slightly older. Whereas a lot of the older, you know, I suppose the grandfather generation, you know, my father's generation, that kind of sort of 60-odd-year-olds, they were like, robots, that's a great idea. That's fantastic. Yeah. And you know, they can possibly remember, you know, the technology really starting to kick off in agriculture and anything, and they can see this as a big benefit.
Yeah.
Whereas some of that kind of mid-generation, some of them are really, they've got the technology when the first technology kind of came around, wasn't maybe that reliable, and they're a bit more shy of the whole thing, not quite so convinced. But it's been really interesting. And then, you know, a year down the line, you know, with the robots been for a year, for it's great, you know, came to see the thing work, and I thought, this is fantastic. You know, people think, well, why does everybody not milk cows, I guess? Well, there's many, many different ways of looking after cows and milking cows. So this is just the way we've chosen to do it.
So with the robots then, what are the, for people who might not know, what are the main differences between that and a conventional milking parlour, apart from the obvious? How does it work?
Basically, what we've got is, instead of having the cows gathered in twice a day or three times a day to be milked, the cows, our cows always have access to the robots. So they'll milk once every 6 minutes, 24 hours a day.
24 hours a day they've got access. Yeah.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So okay.
The cows have access all the time. When the cows are inside, we'd average 3.3 milkings a day.
Okay.
So there's some within that, we calve all year. So within that, we'll have fresh cows and we'll have steel cows come at the end of the lactation.
Yep.
So some of the steel cows will only milk twice a day. Some of the fresh cows, when they're just calved, they can milk up to six times a day. It's their choice.
Yeah,
we encourage them to milk at least three times a day at that stage, but it's their choice. So basically what happens, we've got this thing. It's a Lilly Astronauts, Astronaut A4s we use. There's a cage isn't the right word. There's a set of bars on the outside of the robot, and it's like a pen that the cow walks into. So it walks into it. There's a feed hopper in front of it, and there's a gate closes behind it. So the cow, she's in this cage thing beside the robot, which is a red panel, and then the robot arm comes under the cow and then attaches a cluster to the cow and milks the cow.
Okay.
And then the milk's pumped from there, goes into the bulk tank, the same as... From the point the cow's actually milked, it's exactly the same as anybody else's milking system, although we have to be able to cool milk in a slightly different way because we're cooling milk all the time, and we've had buffer tanks that we can keep milking whenever the bulk tank's been emptied.
Okay.
So we don't have to, you know, dump milk or whatever. But basically the cow, she's standing in this box getting milked, and she can see all her compadres around her, but she's safe from being bullied. She's not getting, you know, some of the timid cows will wait until there's nobody else there and then they'll dive in and get milked.
Yeah.
And they're on a straw yard, so they've got, both sheds actually have got, they're just straw courts that they're in and then a feed passage up each side, and then the robot sits at one end of the shed. And
okay.
The cows have access all the time to get milked. And then when it comes to grazing, there's a grazeway gate that's basically a selector gate. That the cows, they can either, if they go to the gate and they're allowed to go out, it'll put them out to the right pasture, or it'll keep them in the shed until they go and get milked, and then it'll let them out.
And
so it's all...
Are they Holstein Friesians?
Yeah, they're all Holstein Friesians. There's one brown Swiss, and there's three or four Fleck within among them, and there's a couple of... Montbelliards as well.
The
bulk of them are all either black and white or red and white.
So the Holstein Friesians, do they, I'd imagine they suit that system quite well.
Yeah. When we looked at cows to start with, we kind of we thought we wanted to milk cows, so we want a cow that produces plenty of milk.
Yeah.
And we kind of we did look at some of the crossbreeds and things, but we thought we might end up with something or nothing. You know, something with neither a really good dairy cow or a really good beef cow. So we kind of thought, right, we'll go for the Holstein. We'll go for a grazing type Holstein. They're deep bodied Holsteins. They're not the wide extreme animals that you would see maybe in an indoor herd all the time.
No.
But we're looking for, we're actually looking for, an aggressive cow is not the right way to put it, but we're looking for a cow that's prepared to go and to walk. And
you're looking for performance.
Push forward to the feed barrier. Exactly. Push through the feed barrier, push through the robot to get the robot. There's one cow called Ruby. You'll have seen Ruby on the Twitter profile.
Yeah.
And she's a lovely cow, but God, she needs to kick some of the other cows' arses. she's just such a sweet cow that another cow, another young heifer will come to the robot beside her, and she'll just step back and let it go into the robot in front of her, rather than her pushing her way in. We're kind of looking for the cows that'll try and get in, and but obviously not too aggressive either, but. And a grazing type cow as well, is where we're grazing all summer, so we need cows that are able to walk to pasture, graze, and then walk back again, and then go through the whole robot system as well.
So the cows they wear tags around their necks as well, don't they? So they're individually.
We've got a collar around their neck with a number on it, so we know individually identify them, and it's got a transponder on the collar, and it tells the robot which cow it is. It also measures the temperature, the ruminations, and their activity, so that we can tell quite a lot of information from the cows, breeding information, heat information, and health information as well from the cows, from them actually. You go through the readings and go through the robot and go through the grazeway. So it reads it all and feeds it back to the computer, so we can see what's going on with each individual cow. And we can also, when she's milked, we measure cell counts of the milk. Well, the average get measured once a day, but every third milk in the cell count gets measured.
Okay.
And the fat and protein's measured, and the conductivity's measured, and the colour of the milk's measured at every milk. And so if that'll flag something been wrong with a cow before we even see it.
So
it'll flag up a cow where a higher conductivity issue in the milk. And so I look at that and think, right, that's potentially either it's a bit of dirt or something that was picked up, the milk's been a wee bit funny, or it's just starting to get mastitis. So the next milk, and then we look and see that cow, yes, that's starting to be mastitis. And it won't even have got to the stage of being a clinical mastitis yet, but we'll know that it's there, and we'll have picked up on it, and we'll use other mint or something else to try and treat it before we actually get to the stage of having to treat cows with antibiotics.
That's a fantastic management tool then, isn't it?
It's just information overload. Yeah. You can look at these cows and you sort of come away, sometimes your head's spinning and you're thinking, well, what am I doing here? There's just so much information.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes it's sussing what information is important and relevant and what's not.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to try and get it.
Yeah. So are there any, have you had any problems with them? I mean, I'm guessing the technology's improved considerably in the last few years. Have you had any issues at all with them or has it all been fairly straightforward?
No, it's all been pretty good. We've had a few issues, but it's like everything else, it tends to be the penny O-ring lets you down rather than the big component. If every bit of kit on the farm was as reliable as these things are, it would be it'd be amazing.
Yeah.
They work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They never ever stop. They stop long enough for cows. There's a bit of free time that cows aren't actually getting milk, but they're basically either milking or washing all the time.
Mm.
And so it's incredible the reliability they have. We've had a few wee things. There's a vacuum valve. Yeah, vacuum sensor was the last thing that packed that one, but that was 20p sensor packed up, and that was something that we from what the guy was telling me, it was the diaphragm had got sucked out of it. So
okay.
That sounded fair enough to me, but it didn't work. So that was all that I was interested in. But the the Lily Kilmarnock that we use are really, really good at sort of talking us through things down the phone. And we'll be doing it. I'm reasonably competent at trying to fix things myself.
Yeah.
But they're quite happy to sit on the end of the phone and talk you through doing something, and tell you the shortcut to do it and to do it right, and things like that. That can save us a lot of time. Getting the robots back milking again, rather than having to wait until somebody gets across to come down to us and sort it out.
Yeah.
So if they have to come, they'll come. There's not an issue with them not turning out for us, but it's still that thing. And if we can botch it at 3 o'clock in the morning, it means somebody else can stay in their bed, that's fine, and then get them out in the morning rather than having somebody check down halfway down Scotland in the middle of the night.
And that's when your engineering experience comes in handy, I suppose.
I suppose it does.
So it sounds like there's nothing much more goes wrong on them than would on a standard milking parlor then, really.
Yeah.
Because those...
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's doing pretty much the same. What you get with a robot is you get the milking parlor and somebody milk cows, somebody put units in cows 24 hours a day. That's effectively what you get. You get a machine that does that. And, so from a milking parlor point of view, the actual milking process is exactly the same as a conventional parlor.
Yeah.
The arm is the only bit that's different, and really it's not that different to a set of gates or anything else. It's just the way its controls clever.
Yeah. Okay.
And the way the thing works with a nose. But I still, we've done 300,000, 400,000 milkings now or something. I still get a kick out of watching it putting a unit on it.
I'm sure.
Just because then the cow goes, then there you go, it's milking. So it's all quite clever stuff.
Yeah. Well, and if anyone wants to see it in action, you've got you pinned a tweet to your Twitter profile, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's well worth seeing that clip with ITV, and your Twitter profile is for anyone wanting to see it, it's at Farnell_Simmies. But I recommend you check that out. But
it's quite good. When we put the Lily in first, they've been making astronauts for 20 years at that point. So they're, they'll be 25 years now making robots.
Yeah.
So it's new technology, it's not actually that new.
No, no.
We're all getting older, I suppose, the other way of looking at it, but it's actually, the difference, the first robot went in May 2013, the second one in December 2016, and there's not a huge lot of differences, but there's quite a lot of differences in the software inside the thing, the circuitry inside it.
Yeah.
The old robot connects quickly. The new one connects really quickly.
Yeah.
Whenever it gets a guy, if a cow stands still, it'll put the units on as quick as a man can. It really is quite impressive when you see it going.
Do you think more and more robotic milkers will? Do you think it'll become? I think at the moment I read that about maybe just over 5% of dairy herds in the UK are milked with a robot. Do you think it'll become more and more the norm as it gets harder to find people to milk cows? It's unsociable hours and fairly low pay. Do you think they'll become more the norm?
I think there's definite scope for more cows to be milked robotic. It was one of the last things we sort of heard from Lily was that apparently if anybody's looking at putting in a new milking system, a new powder, whatever else, generally people are looking at robots as well as a powder.
Yeah.
And they reckoned, because at one stage they reckoned that 50% of the new, 50% of that kind of changeover would be robots. So there is a huge potential there, but it's a very different way of milking. You work with your cows a different way. You're not chasing cows all the time. The only time we'd go and chase cows and collect cows is when we're sweeping them out of paddocks and when we're grazing. So we sweep them out of the paddocks sort of 3 times a day, and that's purely just to keep them moving past the robot
and
get them onto fresh grass to try and get as much in the grass as we can. But the only cows we like to collect are cows that are late. So I'll be cows that are, we're aiming for a sort of an 8 hour, 10 hour milking interval. So we, when I go out in the morning, I'll see, you'll see a collect cow list, and it'll tell me the sort of the half dozen cows, the 3 or 4 cows that are late.
Yeah.
And generally they're late for a reason. They're sort of the sick, the lame and the lazy. So there's, if a cow's late, there's generally a reason for it. Sometimes they just extran. There's some cows we've had and they're just not interested in the milk at all. But eventually they catch on. But they tend to be the cows that you're collecting every day, and you collect them every day for a week, and then suddenly the penny drops and they get on with it themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, but that's generally the only cows that we're actually chasing up, whereas in a parlor system, you're potentially getting in and getting 400 cows at one point and pushing them all in one direction through a parlor to feed to out. You know, so it's a different way of working with the cows. And there's a lot of the, you know, once you get onto big herds, you know, large numbers of robots, it's the economics are going to change. There will come a point that you can, that it is cheaper possibly or cost effective maybe to start employing people.
Yeah.
Put in a rotary parlor, put in a big herringbone, employ a couple of Polish guys, whatever, to milk cows. But then again, you need to make sure, you know, it's a different people are going to suit different things at some time. You know, but I think there is a huge potential for, you know, mechanization generally in this kind of thing. They do all sorts. They do feed pushers, they do robotic feeders, they do scrapers, all this kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's amazing the number of things that are actually being looked at now, and they can actually see, well, yeah, this works. Like all these robotic tractors and things they're looking at now, and you think the technology is just moving on.
It's amazing, amazing how quickly that will happen, isn't it? You know, now, like you sort of think, oh, that's a long way away, but it really isn't, is it?
And you know, back to what we were speaking about earlier, about young people wanting to farm. There's a lot of people, young people, do want to farm. But there's a huge number of young people who don't, and a huge number of young men, young women don't want to work stupid hours, don't want to get up at stupid o'clock in the morning, don't want to work 24 hours a day in a dusty, dirty, smelly environment.
I don't know why, because you're selling it so well there. What's wrong with them?
Well, yeah, you wonder sometimes.
I quite agree. Well, I mean, when you see the as you say, even just the feed pushers, when you see them working, the early feed, you know, it's very impressive, isn't it? It's quite relatively simple technology, I guess. But
that's right. And again, you know, it's all these things that are just, you know, it's the technology. To me, the technology that works really well is a technology that they've looked at and thought, right, this is a job. Like feed pushing is a classic example. Ideally, you want to push up your feed 6-8 times a day.
Yeah.
You're not going to go along. You're not going to walk through your court 6 times a day and push it up. You're not going to drive a tractor through there 6 times a day and push it up. We've got this thing that does it. That's ideal, because that's you getting things done right with technology that's there to do it.
That's right. Well, again, it's improving management, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you also said that you're converting to organic. I didn't realise that, and I never had you down as a hippie.
No, I'm definitely not the croc wearing tight, to be fair. I'm not even going to rise to that bit.
So what's prompted that decision then?
Well, when we moved to Graham's, they were one of the reasons they were looking for an organic milk supply. And we looked at it, and initially it was, no, that's not an option. That's not going to work. And then looked at it and thought about it and spoke to a couple of guys around a bit here. There was actually a chance conversation with a guy around a bit here that sort of made me really think about it. And thought, this actually sounds quite feasible, because he's been organic for a long time and he's milking cows, and thought, actually, this could work quite well. And the thing I was really worried about was how we're going to produce feeding for cows and how we're going to actually treat cows if something went wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, anything else. So we spoke to a few guys, including James Robinson down at Strictly.
Yeah.
And so it was like a phone conversation with him, because they've been doing it for a while as well.
Yeah.
And that really convinced us. And it was one of those things as well. Like, it kind of, I was, Kate's always been the one that was kind of the organic gardener and liked the whole, she'd probably be the hippie. She's the flower child. She was the one, she would have been the one that would always been open to that kind of end of things. I used to sell chemicals for a living.
That's right.
I wasn't really that, you know. I could see it was a means to an end.
There's not many organic agronomists around, is there?
That's very true, yeah, so we kind of, it was another one of those things that sort of said to Kate, this is what we're doing.
Yeah,
that's a great idea. And I was like, thank Christ for that. Right, find them in here, this is working. So we started converting a year past January. So we're sort of 6-7 months away now from getting organic conversion. And really... Yeah. We're growing grass. We've planted a clover and grass. We're getting, last year, I was really quite worried. This time last year, I was really quite worried that we weren't going to have enough silage, that we weren't going to have enough feeding for cows. And, you know, I was just proved completely wrong. I couldn't believe the amount of clover. We've got clover, with clover growing in it. You know, it's just incredible the amount of clover we've got. We've produced better silage and not that much less of it than we would have done with took a nitrogen up, which was, made me really think, what the hell were we throwing nitrogen in this stuff for?
Yeah.
So this year, a lot more relaxed. I know it's going to work. Quite happy with it. We're, you know, the crops are clean. There's no weed issues among silage. We're converting the farm in sort of three stages. Like, the first stage finishes or becomes fully converted January 2018.
Okay.
The next 40-acre is January 2019, and the next 200-acre is January 2020. So it's kind of just a year down the line. And that's just to kind of split it up a bit and sort of break things up. So
yeah,
we weren't going to end up too caught out, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the real, probably the real driver for it was to get away from the volatility of the milk price.
Mm.
That was one of the the major drivers for it, because I think organic has been very, very well marketed. They've got a really, really good, secure product base and buyer's base.
You know, yeah.
People that will buy organic and nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, like Kate's brother, he's down in London, and a bit of London there, and, you know, they can't buy anything that's not organic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that kind of...
That's right, yeah.
That kind of thing is, you know, so... And it, but as I say, for us, it was purely... We were, for the last year and a half, we've more or less... Well, for the last year, we've pretty much been organic anyway, but before that, we were really being organic just purely by necessity, because we were trying to scrimp and save everything we possibly could.
Yeah.
So we were nearly there anyway, so we thought, well, this is going to work. So so that's how we did it. But as I say, it's the price driver was the big thing that really pushed us down that line.
So I think the buzzword at the moment is future proofing your business, isn't it? So it sounds like you
absolutely. And that's really what we're aiming to do, was to get us, the fact that it's got us onto a secure milk contract with a secure pricing structure that's not going to be open to the same volatility, the same price changes as a conventional milk price. There will undoubtedly be ups and downs, but speaking to guys, you know, the organic price we went up and down sort of a penny and a half before we were up and down 9 and 10 pence. So you know, it's a lot more stable.
Yeah, it's hard to run your business when it's like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Mm. Oh, okay. Well, that's fantastic. So you've also got, just wanted to ask you briefly a bit about social media and you've got a great, I looked on your website, you've got a great website there for your Simmental cattle.
I haven't been updated for a long time.
Well, I was really impressed with it. Have you try and use social media and that sort of, you've obviously used it in conjunction with your business then, really. Is that sort of something you try and do? And
Yeah, we started off the website originally to sort of sell Simmental bulls. That was one of the big things we were doing. We're trying to breed pedigree bulls and sell the bulls at Stirling, at Perth, Carlisle, you know, the bull sales and sell. And we actually always sold quite a lot privately.
Yeah.
And it was really, it was kind of a way to market them, and a way for people to contact, and another point of contact. Because I kind of looked at it when I was looking for something to buy something. You look on so the company's website, and if it's a good website, if it changes, if it's interesting, you'll possibly go back and buy something.
Yeah.
But if it's not, if you go to the website and it hasn't changed, and you go to the website again and it still hasn't changed,
yeah,
like, forget that, go on to the next one. And ours, to be fair, probably hasn't changed for about 4 years.
No one's buying them then, are they?
No, well, actually, we've actually dispersed all the salmon pools in the spring of this year, so we've got two bulls and two heifers left, and that's all the paddock, the final salmon pools that are left. And that was just purely down to a space thing. We've got so many dairy cows and things, and lack of space for them, so we sold most of them private. Well, we sold them all privately, and a few went through the market as well, right now. So we kind of ran numbers down. So the social media thing kind of started. Somebody mentioned Twitter, and I thought, that's quite good. Yeah, we'll do that. And at that stage, we had a final Simmental profile on Facebook, and we thought, well, link the two together, and I sort of did that, and then unlinked them again. We ended up with 14 like rubbish floating back and forth between them.
Yeah.
And then put on Twitter, and find Twitter just to be a really good kind of support network. Hopefully we've managed to help some people through Twitter, and I've definitely had help through Twitter, just asking questions, and you'll get an answer from a farmer, from a stockman, from a beekeeper. I was talking to somebody about bees the other night. Things like this, and just you get an answer from somebody that doesn't have an axe to grind.
Yeah,
guys try to sell you stuff as well, but there's generally, you can get people there that are actually just telling you the information you want to know in a non-commercial way. And farming, it can be quite lonely. If you're mowing grass, tweeting up and down, put the kinks in it, the Twitter kink in it, I think, was Peter's phrase. It's somebody talking to you, it's somebody interesting going on, it's somebody else doing the same thing as you're doing, and it just makes, you know, as farmers, we can spend a lot of time on our own.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll be at Siley's next week. And if I go out, I could be mowing grass for 12, 14 hours. And you're on your own in the tractor with radio to you on, your can of Coke in the box, and you crack on, and you start to think about things and things. Potentially, it's not very, it can be constructive. It can be kind of destructive time as well. So I find Twitter was quite good to tweet to people, and, you know, just have a bit of conversation, a bit of fun.
I
generally try to keep it fairly lighthearted and try and avoid politics and everything else.
You don't seem to take it too seriously, is that fair?
There's a few serious, we've sort of had a few conversations with some sort of vegans and things. Kind of thought, I've tried my best and just thought, no, life's too short. There's sort of the equivalence of sort of religious zealots. You get on with it. You don't preach to me.
That's right. Yeah.
And let them kind of get on with it. But no, it's been quite good. We've met some really nice people over Twitter as well, and just that we've come across and various people have come to see us, and we've been to see them and kind of things. I think it's just quite a good non-structured support network. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'd say the same. It's so easy to just go on there, isn't it, and have a chat and have a moan about how crap your day's been.
That's right. You tweet away, and then you realise the hash you'd made at the field, and you've got to publish a picture of it on the way back up the field of the kingdom. I think a lot of people, you know, looking at the sort of the followers and things like that, there's quite a lot of followers aren't farmers. They're not interested in farmers They're interested in farms and farming, but they're not from that background themselves.
Yeah.
And I did the Farmers of the UK site.
Yeah, you
and
did
that
a brilliant
was really
work on
good.
That.
That was
yeah.
that was a great thing to do because there's a lot of people follow me on there and still follow and still ask about the cows and you're tweeting and if somebody tweets me, I will generally try and reply to them or if they yeah. ask a question, I'll try and answer the question. But a lot of them you put up a picture of the cows grazing and you'll get people will like it and retweet it and everything else, and that's great. And that's all a lot of people, that's what they want to do. They just want to see if they're working in their office in the middle of London or Birmingham or whatever it happens to be, and they can look at their Twitter feed and see a picture of a cow grazing and think, yeah, that's yeah. what it's about. And that kind of it makes somebody smile. That's
yeah.
really good, doesn't it?
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, I think you're a great example of a family dairy farm in this country. And for anyone who's not already, I would recommend to follow you on there because, you know, you can be quite entertaining occasionally as well. So
just occasionally.
No, it's great fun on there. And I think we've all made some friends on there, haven't we? So
absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think I'm probably taken up enough of your time now. So we'll start to wrap it up. I've got five quick questions to ask you now.
I've got half an hour to answer these.
No, I say this to everyone I've interviewed so far. I say I've got five quick questions and I never get quick answers. I have to change the name of the quiz, I think.
Well,
I'll ask you these and we'll go from there. So if you weren't a farmer, what would you be?
I'd be a joiner.
A joiner?
My father was a joiner.
Okay.
And I did quite a lot of joining and hanging doors and generally working with wood when I was younger. And that's kind of how I financed myself through college to a degree between there and working on farms. I did basically, but it's a joiner. I work for people.
Right. Okay. Gross. There's not much you haven't done, is there? Yeah, be a handy man to have around you. A bit of engineering, bit of joining.
Jack all trades, master unknown.
So I know you like a bit of tractor music, like me. So what's your favourite song?
It depends. It depends on my mood, what I'm doing, what I'm listening to. I like a lot of Iron Maiden, AC/DC, Rumjacks. Dropkick Murphys,
all good stuff. Yeah,
and I love the music I've got in my iPod. Very very eclectic mess. Like Gordon Lightfoot, the Edmund Fitzgerald. That's a song that's really sticking in my head at the minute.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, and this
that
is
wasn't
this
a short answer either.
I wasn't expecting short answers. So this is
going to get them either.
This is the big one: Irish whiskey or Scottish whiskey?
Oh, Irish.
Irish whiskey.
Irish has to be Bushmills.
Okay.
Because my grandfather on my mother's side was the joiner in Bushmills Distillery.
Oh, okay.
And if you go there today, you can still see bits of his work over there. Up until one of the things that they got whenever they worked in the distillery, they used to be given a nip every day, but then they had to stop that because of the whole custom and excise thing. So they gave them a bottle a week when they were working there.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the number of bottles of whiskey they were taking about home.
Yeah, yeah.
And then whenever grandfather died, they always gave, whenever he retired, he got a dozen bottles a year.
Okay.
I think they gave to him.
Yeah.
And then once he died, then they carried on giving my grandmother half a dozen bottles a year.
Oh, wow.
When she was still living. So,
yeah,
that was the old Bushmill distillery.
Oh, wow. I like Bushmills. It's one of my favourites.
Oh, it's great stuff.
Yeah, okay.
That was kind of. Whenever mum was making the Christmas cake, there was more whiskey in it. you don't like the Christmas pudding, the thing wouldn't go out.
So what one subject do you wish you knew more about?
One subject? Dairy farming. No. One subject I wish I knew more about. I wish now having history is something I would like to know a bit more about.
Yeah, okay.
Because I love now, when we were taught history at school, the Heaney Sayers, it was very, very dry and
yeah.
And, yeah. 66 and this. And like, history is not something I had a huge interest in at school.
Yeah.
But it's something that I've, I kind of really enjoy watching. You know, some of these things that you see where they, you know, they not quite the reenactments, but whenever they look into the past and
yeah.
see it, and
yeah.
you know, the how things actually transpired, and you know, like Dan Snow doing his bits with the Navy and all this kind of stuff, and the history
great,
that we never
yeah.
get taught about. You know, the history
yeah.
was just oh, the Navy sailed there and sunk the fleet, and that was it. You know, well, hang on, what's the
yeah,
story? You know,
that's right. The well, I guess it, yeah, back. The internet's made it a lot easier, hasn't it, to study these things in a more accessible way, isn't it, than when we were in school?
Yeah. But, Yeah. And there was that at the end of the last year, was it? The First World War tweets and blogs and things were going on.
Yeah.
And I think you did one, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a few.
That was,
yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. That was really interesting, just the sort of the timeline of what was happening.
Yeah.
I just sort of listened to that and thought, Christ, can you imagine being there and the way it was going on? And just
that's
it brought the whole thing to life, I think. And I think that's what makes it more accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, okay. So and last but not least, if you had to recommend one farmer to follow on Twitter, who would it be?
Well, I was about to say you, but I'll have to score after here.
Nobody says me.
Score you two off the list. I'd say follow the Team Derry hashtag.
Yeah.
Because there's so many really, really good tweeters out there that are, you know, phenomenal cowmen as well.
Yeah.
And look, I'm doing a really good job and really interesting people to follow. There's Andrew Patterson. He's always good to hear about the weather forecast. Like Fiona Graham can always make you feel hungry.
Yeah.
Sarah and Bob Drummond can always tell you, you know, the adventures of turning organic and cats and Ayrshire cows. You know, there's Ian Dickinson can always make you think, you know, few thoughts of, you know, looking after cows and things.
Yeah.
You can, you know, Neil Baker, you know, they won the Gold Cup two years ago. And, you know, I've met a lot of time for Neil's tweets as well. So, you know, there's, and Tibber Dog, you know, how could you forget Tibber Dog, Richard Roberts, you know, there's a huge number of guys out there that are doing great work. Stuart Pass, you know, if you said, you just that the list just goes on and on and on and on of people that are there and farmers, and it's, but no, I'd recommend anybody, if you just look for the Team Derry hashtag and you'll not be far wrong. There's a lot of very good tweeters out there, and it's all interesting stuff, but there's plenty of fun in it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good answer.
No, that's a waffly answer.
Right, Alan.
Did you say that we avoid politics? That was kind of a political answer, not answering the question. The answer never knows but the question. I'm not going to answer the question you asked me. I'm going to answer the question I want you to ask me.
Well, everyone does it. Everyone does it. There you go. Right, Alan. It's been fantastic to speak to you after following you for so long on social media. And you know, if you are ever down here in this neck of the woods, please call in. It'd be great to meet you in person.
Yeah. Absolutely, but likewise, you're passing as well, Colin. It'd be good to see you. We've met a few Twitter people. Yeah, Twitter people is probably the right phrase.
Yeah.
Over the years, and it's really nice to put faces and indeed voices to the tweets. Because you generally see a picture.
Yeah.
And it's a voice, you know, you and Gareth, and you hear the Welsh accents, Pete, the abominable snowman from Yorkshire, you know, that kind of thing. So it's all really good tonight. Nice to meet people. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
That's been fantastic. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and for the ongoing support. Hugely appreciated as always. You can find the podcast from my Twitter page, Stitcher or iTunes. If you've got a minute, you're enjoying these podcasts, please can you leave me a positive review, please, on iTunes to help grow the podcast a bit. And thanks again. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.
I'll go. Oh, hang on. I might have a. I've got a child coming in the room. Hang on a minute. Just 1 minute. Here. Off to go to the bedroom. Go on, off you go. I'm busy. She's in the kitchen, I think. Yeah. You have to go and look for her. Go on, shut the door. Go on. Daddy's busy.
What are you doing?
I'm on the phone. Go on, out. Shut the door. I'll come and tuck you in after.
So that's how professional I am.
Which one was that?